I just am very convinced that we're sitting in the middle of a very, very important time in the history of our movement. And I don't know whether you ever see the real importance or the real significance of something that you're involved in directly, and we're all sitting in it. I don't know whether we may have to read about it years later to realize just what it was that happened and how important or to what degree it was important in the direction of the movement that we're in. If you'll let me just have about 2 or 3 minutes to digest this barbecue. When Howard said, "Have you eaten?" I said, "No, have you?" He said, "No." I said, "Is there any place where we can get a bar?" And I didn't even get the cue out. He said, "Right, come on." So I knew I touched a nerve. I thought I liked barbecue, but it was all over his chin and his arms. And whenever I eat it, I always break out. Up here, there's not much hair to hold the moisture in it. And it started running down my face, and I was wiping and eating, so we had a great time together for supper. I think what we're seeing today in the Boston movement began to make such an escalation during the summer months, during June, July, and August. It seems that the escalation was so pronounced that we began to see perhaps the surfacing of some extremes that we perhaps had suspected were there, but we didn't maybe have any concrete evidence that were there. And I want to just kind of go back and start with that and be as concise as I can and be as definitive as I can and to be as Christian as I can, and because I'm convinced that what Brother Norton does and what I do and what you do and the way we address this matter will determine to a great extent the spirit that's going to be generated throughout the country. And I don't quite know where to go with it. I don't know whether you know where to go with what we're seeing. If we treat each other in this present crisis like we have treated one another in the last 100 years in our movement, then we'll just divorce them and go on about our way and another sect will have formed. Because we're not much for tolerating people that differ with us. We just don't have the skills that it seems that it is required to work through the hard times and come out still holding on to each other. We would much rather divorce than to wrestle. And I don't know whether that colors what you're hearing me say or not. I'm terribly concerned about what I see happening. But I'm concerned about what I've seen happening over the last 100 years and the way we treat each other. And I just want to make sure I don't become someone who perpetuates the very thing that I have abhorred and that you abhor. And the prayer that was led just now was meaningful. And I want us to make sure that we approach whatever it is that we're involved in and whatever it is that they're involved in. I just pray that we will approach it in a way that will bring God glory and that will set a tone that will address the issues and at the same time honor and respect one another as children of God. And we must do that. I just feel like that the time has come when several things need to be addressed in the brotherhood as a whole that will allow us to benefit from the good things in each other and to address and discard the things in each other that are not good. If we could do that, there's enough good in the worst of us and enough bad in the best of us that if we would just pool from all of us that which is the best in all of us, we would have a pretty good, well-rounded movement. But we don't seem to be able to do that with much grace. May God bless us and help us to do it. Back in June, I noticed that there were some things taking place. We left Boston, and Burlington rather, and went south for the summer for the very purpose of letting that church decide some things about our resignation. We had resigned as of March of this next year. And I wanted them to have an opportunity to meet, to have this young man, Jesse Struth, preach for them during the summer rather than just fill in willy-nilly for me while I was gone. He was a young man, about 35 years old. But anyway, I wanted them to have a chance to hear him. And I would need to be a way to let them get an idea that I'm really gone. I'm not going to be up there another year. They went for 2 years to begin with to try to get them through a crisis. They just panicked when the 2 years came around, and so we stayed a third. And then they panicked at the third year, and we were staying a fourth. So I said, okay, this is it. I'm gone, and I'm going to give you a taste of what it's going to be like, and it's not going to be as bad as you think, so just buckle down. And so we left. And began then out of Searcy, Arkansas, to base our work for the summer. We worked mostly at Fort Smith, Arkansas, for 10 of those 14 weeks. And but the phone there at a little cottage in Searcy, Arkansas, the phone literally rang off the wall. And if it wasn't Jerry Jones calling, it was people that he had directed to call. And if it wasn't they, it was someone else. And it seems like that things were escalating to such a degree that we were sensing a time of uneasiness even among their own churches, the churches they had established. This is one of the significant things that came about because of the pressing to the ultimate logical conclusion. Some of their philosophical bases for their movement, one of which is the authority issue. Another was the authority issue as it was projected on top of an ecclesiastical ordering of church polity and church organization that's pretty pronounced. And they began to come in. They came into Atlanta, and the church in Atlanta Highlands split. That was a traumatic occurrence there. But just generally over the summer, things began to escalate so rapidly that we began to sense that there was a spinning almost out of control and an obsession with something that, and they had come so tunnel vision, it seems that nothing really else mattered. And that's an imbalance that's in them. The Burlington Church has an imbalance in the other direction. They're so non-focused in a sense that, and so laid back that we're the other extreme. What we're trying to do is pull us, the Burlington Church, up nearer to the norm, nearer to the medium. But over the summer, things kept developing, kept escalating, till we returned to Burlington in the latter part of August. And we began to there sense the immediate effects of the things that they were beginning to practice all over the country. Those immediate effects were that there was an increasing fallout. There was an increasing intensity that was being experienced by the people who were walking away from Boston. And when you talk about these people and refer to them as people who fall away, they'll stop you right in the tracks and say, no, sir, we didn't fall away, we walked away. They won't let you call them fallaways. These are people who have walked away. There are about 55 or 60 members of the Burlington Church now that have walked away from Boston movement. And there's not a week that goes by but what someone else calls us on the phone. There's not a Sunday but what there are two or three to four to five to six people, additional new people who come from the Boston Church. It's now noised abroad enough that the trickle has become a stream, and the stream is now becoming a kind of a river. And because they've learned that there's an alternative. For a while, they didn't know that there was an alternative. And I say this, and I've told the Boston elders, and all that I'm telling you, I've told them over and over and over again. I'm not saying a thing to you tonight that I have not said to them countless times. So I won't. And before I came here, I had sent a letter to Howard explaining this move in detail to him in writing so that it would be clear, at least, to him. about this meeting tonight. But I sent the same letter to Al Baird and Bob Gimple, the elders of Boston. Then met with Al Baird and before a couple of weeks ago to talk with him about the plans and to ask him what he thought about them and to explain what we were trying to do and what we were not trying to do. And so all that I'm saying here tonight, I've said to them before I came. But we began to sense this increased flow, and the people that were coming were not just people who had been there for 6 months and who had walked away because of one reason or another. Some of these people had been there for 7 and 8 years. These people were evangelists. They were preachers of the gospel before they went there. During the summer, we were aware that the intense pressure had created a defection on the part of men who were at Boulder, people who were at Fort Collins, Colorado, not just Atlanta, but there were good men. Jerry Jones, in the meantime, had pulled away and has now completely severed all connections with him. They severed the connections with him. And it's because he wouldn't accept the extreme position that they hold on the authority issue and the high-handed authority legalistic approach that they take to it. Jerry couldn't do that. He found that he couldn't do it. It was contrary to what the Spirit of God that was in him would not allow him to do it. Maybe it was his personality. But he gave it a fair shot for 2 years. They mashed and squeezed on him every way possible. And people ask me, what about Jerry Jones? And I told Jerry this past summer, I said, Jerry, I've just been telling them that when the cookie cutter came down, there was too much of you hanging over the sides. And they just, and he just laughed and said, well, that's about right. He couldn't bring himself to be brought into that real strict and rigid form that they insist on if you're going to be a part of the movement. They won't allow you to do it otherwise. Well, all of this information began to come in from different places. The defection of certain men, the defection of certain whole churches who would not be brought into the Boston orbit. And some of this is sounding, I know it may sound terribly strong, and I don't mean for it to. This is just the way it is. I'm not branding it. I'm just reporting on what's happened. Churches have been either asked to conform to the norm, or else they would have to pull out of the orbit. So according to, and this is an indirect report from Rule Lemons, but according to Rule Lemons, through a man who has himself been a part of one of the discipling churches, but Rule says that there are 14 churches of their own who have been either split or reorganized or have pulled out of the orbit. And I told them, whenever they, at Ganderbrook Retreat in the latter part of September, just after the World Evangelism Seminar, when the remnant theology surfaced, and Al Baird and both Kit and Al spoke on the remnant, and they've identified themselves as the remnant. I said, well, where does that leave the preachers? Where does that leave the rest of us in this area immediately that have to associate with you, or you have to associate with the rest of us who are the non-remnant? Where does that leave us? Because once a month we get together and pray and sing and speak to one another. I said, where does that leave us? And I said, to whom were you speaking? Well, when you said that, to whom were you talking? If it was to your own members, all it's going to do is blow up their egos higher than they already are. And if it was to us you were directing it, all you've done is offended us and alienated us. I said, I don't know why you would use that. And I said, furthermore, I've never heard of the remnant identifying themselves as the remnant. I had to apologize for that one. I said that to him in Terry Smith's front room. I said, I've never known the remnant to identify themselves as the remnant. Well, I realized I was wrong. And so at the Ganderbrook Retreat, when we met, all the preachers in that area met, and we asked that they meet with us to kind of figure out what are some of the implications of the remnant theology on those that you associate with every month, at least. And I, uh, I told them, I said, I want to apologize first, Al, because I had made a statement that really wasn't true. I said, Elijah once identified himself as the remnant. And he got slapped down for it. The Lord said, you're ignorant, Elijah. You're depressed, but you're ignorant. I've got 7,000 men that haven't bowed the knee to Baal. So I said, there was a time when the remnant identified itself, but it didn't work out all that well. And Paul refers to it in Romans, the 11th chapter, I think it is, where he says, there is a remnant today, but he says it's by grace, not by works. And I just told them to their face, you have had the audacity to identify the remnant in exactly the opposite terms that the Apostle Paul identified the remnant. I said, you're saying the remnant is based upon works. Paul says it's based upon grace. And I said, you need to apologize. I said, you've made a terrible mistake. I said, frankly, you've shot yourself in the foot. And I said, you've stuck it in your mouth. And you shot yourself in the foot before you stuck it in your mouth. And I said, you're just going to have to repent. And you need to apologize and ask God to forgive you and ask us to forgive you. Well, that was said publicly, so I have no reason to not tell you. Al and I are on, we're either on no speaking terms or on such speaking terms that we can say things like that to each other. And he's a good man. And Bob Gimple is a good man. You won't find two better men than these men. But anyway, and I didn't make any outline. I'm just trying to kind of bring you up to date as to how things happened at the Gander Brook Retreat then. It sort of came to a head there. And the 20 or so or 30 congregations in that whole area met. Not all of them were there, but a good number of them were. And we met, and Al and Bob came, and we spoke. And then later on we went and we had dinner with them, took them out as they went on back south to Boston, and talked with them further. And it was at that point that I just told Al, I said, Al, you are the hard-headedest man I think I've ever known in my life. And I'm thankful that he lets me get away with things like that. But he is so convicted that what he's doing is right that he can't hear. He cannot hear. And he cannot see the flaws. And he cannot see the devastating effect that what they're doing is having. And you know, it's not that he's causing it in the sense that it's not direct, it's indirect. It's in the philosophy, and I tell them there's a flaw in the whole system. And I say it's not in you personally, in the leadership, in Al and the elders. And I don't know Kip that well. But it's not in those two men, but in the philosophy that says that the authority that a discipler has over the disciplee is equivalent to the authority that Jesus Christ has over his apostles. That's a flawed philosophy. But it doesn't come out really until you hand that thing on down through the various echelons of leadership, until you get it down to the very lowest ranks of it, and you hand that authority into the hands of people who are novices, who are not equipped experientially nor with the Spirit of God to a sufficient degree that they know how to handle that kind of an authority over people's lives. It's not until it comes down through the ranks and filters down to those people, that's where the abuses come. And there's an awful lot of abuse coming. But Al can't see it because his own heart is not abusive. He's an authoritarian. But he's wise, and he knows how to treat people. And whenever you report these abuses to him, it just shocks him and it saddens him. But, you know, nothing's done about it because the philosophy has not been renounced. Now, Yesterday, a meeting of the preachers in the area was held at the Burlington Church Building. And there were about 50 of us present. There were about 35 preachers and other brethren and about 15 of their wives. And we met to discuss this issue. And I want to just focus in on this issue as being, this is the jugular, I'm convinced of it. I may be proven wrong, and we'll have to adjust it and something else may prove to be the bottom line. Last month, in the month of October, we had the preacher's meeting, and about 30 men came then. First time there had been that many people in a preacher's meeting in that area in years. But they came because the subject to be discussed was authority. the authority issue. And Al Baird spoke, I spoke, and then we had a book report, and then we broke up into small groups and discussed the things among ourselves. Then we came back and had reports. But at that meeting, I just made the statement that there's something else that is more basic than the authority issue. And I said, I propose that we discuss this next week or next month. And so it was agreed. This was the subject. In the transition from the realm of the flesh to the realm of the spirit, is it necessary or scriptural to bring people through the realm of law? Now, do you understand what was the subject? Is it necessary to bind externals and bind the structures and give, don't touch and don't taste and do? Is it necessary? Is that a part of the maturing process for the Christian? Al spoke on it in the affirmative and defended it very ably. In fact, when he got through, and while he was doing it, and he's a very capable man, a very convicted man, a very convincing man, by the time he got through, you thought, boy, I don't know whether we're going to be able to say anything that will offset it. Well, in addition to that, James Walters, who was supposed to be there to speak, I didn't see him come in. I knew he was going to be late. I didn't see him come in. And about 15 minutes before Al was finished, I looked around and I panicked. I said, he's not going to make it. And so I grabbed my pen and feverishly began to make notes to try to present the other side, and got up ready to speak and looked down, and there he was waiting to be introduced. Well, I nearly fainted. I thought, praise the Lord. I said, when did you get in here and how did you get in here? I didn't see you come in. But anyway, I was so glad that he was there. But by the way, after he spoke, the whole room was glad he was there. It was the most definitive exposition of the book of Galatians I've ever heard anywhere. And that, I'm convinced, is the jugular of this whole movement. It is the question of whether or not the question of Galatians and the question of Colossians and the issue of Acts 15, whether or not that is part and parcel with Christianity. I've got a copy of the tape here. I want to leave it with Howard, if you will, and any of you that would like a copy of it. I'm sure you have the facilities here to do it. You've got the machinery that you can copy it and send it and make it available to you. Get it, by all means. What happened yesterday, I'm convinced, is the most significant. It's the most significant and definitive statement that has been made in this movement. I mean, it is top drawer. I think it's the first time since this movement has become visible. I believe it is the first time that the initiative was taken out of the hands of the Boston Brethren. I think it was the first time that they were put on the defensive. And you may think, well, you're talking awfully strong. That's exactly the way I feel that it was the turning point. If there's to be a turning point, it happened yesterday. James Walters is a professor from Harding University who is in Boston doing his doctoral work in the New Testament world at Boston University. He's about 32 years old. Do you know him? Outstanding scholar. And what was done yesterday on both sides was as definitive of both positions. It wasn't that we didn't have the best man for the Boston perspective. We had we had their spokesman. And he did an outstanding job. But when James Walters stood up and took the book of Galatians and just expounded it, it was truly significant. And I just can't say enough about it. Everyone there was just elated. Light had shone, and it was beautiful. We were thankful for that. What's happening in the Boston area is significant. It is impacting the whole church in the Brotherhood. You can count on it. You know that's true. It's impacting it is having an impact here, maybe not like it is in other places yet, but I'm convinced that it will. I think what they're doing is going to impact the whole church in the whole world. I think it's that it has that potential. In fact, it's already doing it. So where does that leave us? Well, after getting back after the summer, and these events that took place during the summer, and the events that took place at Ganderbrook, and the event that took place yesterday, we had already made our plans before this happened yesterday, but yesterday was a confirmation of in a way that I'm surprised at, in a sense. I'm confident that we have the scholarship. I'm confident that we have the manpower. I'm confident that we have, I hope, the Spirit of Christ. I'm confident that we have what all it takes to make an initiative. We're going to have to take the initiative. We can't sit around any longer and huddle over in the corner and tremble at what these people are doing and try to react to it only. That we can't do that. We're going to have to take the initiative. And so after months of this, and after being there about 3.5 years and seeing what was happening firsthand and really fighting it, fighting against coming to this conclusion. In fact, I'd gone to Searcy last month to accept an invitation to teach at the university and to preach there with one of the congregations. I went there fully intending to buy a house and to move, and I got down there. I could not do it. I could not imagine myself being in Searcy. Not that I have a thing against Searcy, but I just couldn't bring myself to walk away from what I feel like is a need there that you can't deny. It's there. It's going to have to be reckoned with. So I just told them, I said, well, I just can't do it. We're going to have to take care of what's there. So I went back, and Louine said, what was this deal we made that you would not make any decision before you came home? I said, well, honey, I had told her, I said, now I won't do anything until I get in touch with you. And I said, well, I really didn't do anything. I guess that's what was so obvious. I didn't do anything, so it almost means that I have done something by default. And what we're calling what's happening, we're calling it a happening. Louine dubbed it a happening because we haven't planned any of this. It's just happened. And we're caught in the middle of it and are just simply doing what we have to do. And from the people that are sitting on our couch who are in a state of psychologically damaged emotions, and they cry and they have flashbacks, they have what they call triggers in the scriptures. They say, I can't even read the Bible anymore, because whenever I read it, there's a trigger that they put in there that triggers things in my mind that I can't handle emotionally. It's serious, and I say this, I've told Al this, and he does, he, bless his heart, he cannot grasp it. But I'm telling him, there is phenomenal damage being done to lots and lots of people. By his own statement to me, and he's probably made it publicly, last year they lost 250 people from the move, 250 from Boston. And that's, I'm convinced, a conservative count, but he acknowledged 250. This year, there's more than that, but this has been the case now for at least 4 or 5 years. There have been 250, 200, 300 people lost every year. That means there are some 1,500 people walking around in Boston today who have been told either directly or it has been implied that if you leave Boston, you leave God. There's no hope for you. It's either this or nothing. It's such an insidious egotism that breeds egotism, and it is such an insidious elevation and an elitism that they seem to have no motivation except that it comes through sectarian elitism. But brethren, we're not totally innocent in that scene. Are you aware of the fact that for the last how many years that you and I can speak, that much of the motivation that has propelled this movement of which we're a part, that much of it has been sectarian elitism? This idea of there being the remnant, They didn't invent that idea. We've given them that impression ourselves, and they've seen the way we've conducted ourselves. And I don't know whether you agree or disagree with that, but believe me, what's happening to us right now in the mainstream is the very thing that we have done to others, except the shoe was on the other foot. And when we were running around considering ourselves many times so righteous and putting everybody else at naught, they've just pushed it to the ultimate conclusion and have had the audacity to announce that they're the remnant of God. But the remnant theology has been present in the thinking of us and our brethren for years. When this was announced by them that they were the remnant, my wife said, the church generally needs to know this. I said, honey, just calm down. Remnant number one has papers, and they're going to tell what remnant number two has said. And the axe will be laid at the root of their tree. So don't think that it's not going to be spread all over the brotherhood by the other remnant. Somehow or other, there's got to be something else that propels us other than sectarian elitism. But it's what it feeds it. And the idea of being the remnant, that makes it so that if you don't get out and tell people, you're the only ones that's got the message. And if you don't tell them, the whole world is going to die and go to hell because you're the only one that has that message. That's what's being communicated to them. And I mean to the degree that they tell them, if you go to Burlington, you're going to hell. And that's not a hearsay. We have people in the Burlington church, and I have a tape, I don't guess I brought it, but I have a tape of a girl who is now with us in the Burlington church, who was for years with the Boston church. And another girl who just walked away and couldn't stand it any longer, finally had to take her phone off the hook, and she put a recording machine and just said, I'm not able to come to the phone right now. Leave a message and I'll get back with you. And this girl just kept calling and kept calling, and she kept getting that message. And finally, she left her message. She left her message on the tape. And I guarantee you, it curled your hair. And one of the things that she said was that if you go over there to that ear-tickling church, you're going to go to hell with the rest of them. Well, you see, the leadership says that's not what we're saying. But I keep telling them, brethren, somewhere along the line, something is being communicated that leaves the impression that when you leave Boston, you leave God. Now, when I look at the way they're doing that, but then I see, by the way, the way we often have conducted ourselves, then I think, you know, they're our children. They're our children. And I can't be too critical of them in that respect, because, by the way, that's the way we've acted in front of them. Except that I can't stand in my children the very things that I tolerate in myself. And you know how that is. When you see things in your children that you just detest, be careful. It's probably a reflection of yourself, and you just can't stand the way it looks in your child. Well, what are we going to do? These brethren are going all over the world. They're going about it with a vengeance. They're going about it with a conviction that says we're in here for the duration. They're selling houses. They're raising $3 million at a whack. They're out beating the bushes. They're standing on street corners. Isn't that good? It is good. The zeal is admirable. Well, what is there that's wrong? Well, there are two or three things. Sitting at the base of all of it, I'm convinced there's another gospel that they're preaching. And I know that's a serious indictment, but I'm convinced there's another gospel. There is at the heart of it, there is a legalism that is one of the finest tuned machines that I've ever seen among us. We don't have anything to compare with it. Because in addition to the legalism that's there, there's a finely organized authoritarianism that is the backbone of it, that is adding it to it in such a degree that it is producing something that I think is out of control. You add to the elitism, the authoritarianism that stands behind that and is represented by their philosophy of authority. You add elitism and authoritarianism together, you get you've got a repressive system. And it's this that's in the seed of it that I'm convinced that I don't think we'll turn them away from. Juan Carlos Ortez, down in Argentina, was also a part of a discipling movement. The discipling movement isn't unique to us, as you know. It's a worldwide movement that Juan Carlos Ortez was a part of. And I used to read his writings and think, my goodness, that's excellent. Excellent material. He came out of a Pentecostal background. But what Ortiz did was, his idea of discipling was not exclusive. It was not elitist. It was more ecumenical. And he would take his philosophy of discipling, and it was reproducing people at a rapid rate down in Argentina. But his was more of an ecumenical mindset, and it was more of a benevolent mindset. And they would take their group and would disband on Sunday nights and would go down to the Anglican church or the Lutheran church, and they would go in there on their Sunday night service, and they would sing together, and they would pray together, and they would encourage those people. And as a result, he became a catalyst for that whole huge city. I forget now which city it is. Buenos Aires, maybe. I'm not sure. But he became more or less of a catalyst, and it was an interdenominational thrust, and he served as a catalyst for encouragement and a revitalization of that whole, probably a dead system of ecumenism or a dead system of the whole Christendom at that time. But he served in that capacity as a catalyst for unity and unification. What he didn't have that this movement has, it has the same discipling method, but it has added to it an elitist mindset that instead of serving as a catalyst for unity, has served as a catalyst for separatism and dividing and division from us. It can't tolerate an alternative. It won't. Were it to tolerate it, it would lose its force. And that's where I think what we're going to be doing is going to have significance. We're convicted that there are several things that we're going to be doing. Number one, we're going to begin an initiative work. We're going to begin initiating. We're not going to sit back and just pick up the pieces of those who, by chance or hook or crook, find us. We're going to begin to surface and become visible. We're going to begin telling it publicly and privately. Probably privately is all it's going to require, because I think it will spread just by word of mouth. And every person that we've met knows 10 or 12 others who have either already left and who just are wandering around not knowing what to do because they don't know that there's an alternative. So we're going to begin becoming visible. That's the first step that we've decided on. We're going to do this by start publishing a brief paper or a newsletter. We're going to try to do it in very fine fashion. We don't want it. If anything that they do first class. You don't put out something if it's not going to be first class. And even then, I'm sure it won't come up to the quality that the Boston Church. When they do something, they do it right. We're going to put out this news bulletin. And we're going to do this probably twice a month. And it will be a positive expression. It's not going to be a hate sheet. I told Al and them, I said, we're not going to come out with some kind of a hate sheet. What we're going to do is simply produce this and send it out with the permission of the people. We're not going to send it to them if they don't want it. If they don't ask us to send it, we're not going to send it. We're not going to harass them and go after them and do the same thing to them that was done, that they ran from. We don't want to do that. But there's a groundswell of reception, of favorable reception of it. But we're going to just simply hold up Christ. It'll be a positive expression of an alternative. And you know, the only alternative that we've got is Jesus Christ. If the people who have walked away from the Boston Church, if all they're doing is walking away from one system into another system that is just not doing quite as successfully, then that won't work. They'll die. If they walk into many congregations today with the emphasis and with the message that we've had, I'm convinced that they'll walk back into a trap that won't give them life either. The alternative has got to be a rediscovery of what the message is. You know, we've had several blips on our horizon in the last 100 years. There was the Bible study blip, and then there's the film strip blip, and the busing blip, and what are some of the other blips? One shot evangelism blip, and all of these various blips but they've all been methodology blips. They've all been methodology blips. Someone will come up with a different methodology. Brethren, I'm convinced as much as I'm standing here tonight that there's got to be a message blip among us. We've got to find out what the message is. And I think that there are many among us that haven't got a clue of what the message is. Boston doesn't have a clue as to what the message is. And I've told them this publicly and privately. I said, you're going to have to discover what the message is. The message is Jesus Christ. And if we don't get back, if we as a movement of people do not wholesale discover that, by the way, we need to get back and examine the message that we've been preaching and realize that for years and years, for the most part, that which has been projected into the community has been a rear-end message. And that doesn't really express it. I'll have to clarify it. We've allowed Billy Graham and others to come in and preach the front end. And they'll preach Christ, and they'll preach the repentance, and they'll bring people to faith, and then they'll just leave them sitting there as though that was all of it. And we just bide our time and wait them out. And when Billy Graham leaves, then we come in and we preach the rear end of the thing and try to bring them on into the kingdom until we've become rear-end gospel specialists. And we've become elliptical. We've become out of balance to where all we have really become equipped as is people who are able to do religious fine-tuning or theological fine-tuning. And in addition to that, our thrust has mainly been to religious people. You think about it. Our thrust has been mainly to religious people in whom we have assumed the presence of faith. And we felt that the only thing they need is some fine-tuning. And so we've become fine-tuners. But that's not going to be sufficient to reach the world we live in today. What we've done, I'm convinced, over the years, that has produced Boston. If we had not done what I'm going to say, if we had not done this, there would have been no occasion for Boston. What we've done over the years, I'm convinced, is assume the presence of faith. We have assumed the presence of faith in those that are around us in the Bible Belt. We have assumed the presence of faith rather than allowing for the process of it. And if you'll think seriously about it, I'm convinced that you'll know that's right. We have assumed the presence of it. In our preaching, we assume the presence of faith without allowing for the process of it. The process of it is a gut-wrenching, time-consuming process that allows a person to ask meaningful questions, to express honest doubt, and to grapple with the same evidence that the disciples grappled with in the first century. And you need not expect people to come to faith without that process in their lives. Because of the fact that we have assumed the process, and people who live in this cultural setting in which we find ourselves usually in the Bible Belt, there is enough of a cultural pressure on them to where they don't really know but what they really do believe, because their granddaddy did and they do, or their parents do. And the culture in which they are living, we have so many things that are culturally set in place that never really does let a person come face to face with the possibility that I may not even believe this whole thing. And as long as we then just approach it from the pulpit and assume that the people out in the pew, 15 years ago, I quit assuming that any assembly of the church was consistent of believers. I quit assuming that. And I've stated this for 15 years. I don't assume any of you believe. And I mean by that not to put anybody down. But I'm just saying I'm committed to throwing the life preserver just as far out as I can. And pulling it in. And let everybody grab on where he finds himself in the process. But I'm not going to be guilty of assuming the very thing that we're put into the world to create or to establish. We cannot assume that people believe. But because we've assumed it, whenever that happens, you don't have to wonder about why it happened. It happened because of the fact that there is faith lacking in the movement. That's the only explanation for inactivity. It's lack of faith. That's what Jesus said. Where he always traced it back to, he'd say, oh, men of little faith, what's wrong? Why did you doubt? But it's produced a situation that, as a result of that, out of that came this other movement, the Boston movement. But I told them yesterday, I said, the fact of the matter is that you have fallen into the same trap that the mainstream church has fallen into. You have assumed the presence of faith, and you're not allowing the process of it. But I said, the problem that you're facing is that you're in such a rush to get to a goal that you've set up as being your goal of reaching the whole world. I said, you've become so obsessed with that goal that you have refused to allow the people that you're contacting the time to come to faith. And instead of allowing them the process to work out in their lives to where they can come to faith, you have assumed again that they believe. And then you've imposed upon them a system of works, a system of morality, a system of activity that assumes that faith exists, but it's not there. Now, that's not a blanket judgment on it. I'm just saying that when people then find themselves, as James Walters says in this speech he gave yesterday, when people find themselves operating out beyond their faith, and when you impose legalism upon people, when you impose your mature standards upon those who are immature, what you do is you end up making those people function out beyond their faith. And when that happens, the oppression of it is enormous to the point that it can't be tolerated. It'll destroy them. And they can stand it up to a certain point, but then finally they won't be able to maintain it. And that's what's happening. It's a common denominator. The common denominator that I see among us as in the mainstream and in the Boston church is this one basic flaw, that is that we've assumed the presence of faith and not allowed for the process of it. And we haven't really known how to allow for the process of it. We've been so equipped, at one of our preacher schools about 6 or 7 or 8 years ago, I was stunned to read their curriculum. And in a preacher school, there was not one single course on the life of Jesus Christ, not one. They had about 15 or 20 courses on how to combat Adventism, how to combat premillennialism, how to combat the Baptist Church, the Methodist Church, the Anglican Church, every type of false doctrine that you could ever think, they had a course in there on how to combat it. But not one single course on the life of the Lord Jesus Christ. I got so mad, it was while you were at Searcy. I got so mad, I called them up by phone. I didn't write them a letter. Why write a letter when you can yell at them over the phone? I called this friend of mine and I said, I am absolutely shocked. I am absolutely astounded that in a school that claims to be a school of preaching the Lord Jesus Christ, you have everything in your curriculum except any course on the Lord Jesus Christ. And you know, he looked at the catalog and he said, well, he said, you're right. And the next year, by the way, that was corrected significantly. But the very fact that we could ever slip into that simply says that we really haven't known how to equip ourselves and get out into the trenches and do whatever it takes to lead people through the struggle of becoming believers in Jesus Christ. And brethren, we're going to have to bite the bullet. The time is on us. We can't afford it any longer. We cannot afford, in the name of whatever it may be, tradition, or in the name of the status quo, or in the name of our roots, or whatever it may be, we cannot afford to go the route that we have found ourselves slipping into that allows for and demands a movement like Boston to come out of us. But they don't have any more of an idea about what the message is than we've had many times. And as a result, they're preaching another, except they've added to it the authority issue, and they've out-elited the elite. And it's produced a very oppressive movement. Well, now, let me close by just, we're going to begin taking an initiative with the publication of this newsletter, and the list of names and all will just be allowed to grow naturally. I asked the elders from Boston if they would give us the names of those who had fallen away. You never know what you ask. they considered it, I think, seriously, and then simply said, we don't have any way of knowing the ones that are no longer, that we're no longer pursuing. I said, all right, that's all right, I understand. I don't know that I could expected them to be able to just say, okay, here's where the line is, and you can have all those on that side, and we'll... So I just thanked him, and I said, well, I understand that. Secondly, after beginning to be visible, we're going to put some things probably in the Boston Herald or the Boston Globe. We're going to send out a letter, I think, first, before we even send out the newsletter. We're going to send out a personal letter with the names of about 60 people who have already left, so that the people who get the letter will be able to recognize a name that's on there and say, oh, it'll give us, I think, immediate credibility where otherwise it'd take a long time to establish it. But we're going to do that. The second thing we're going to do is eventually, in about 2 or 3 months, we're going to begin renting a hall in some central location that's near ground train lines. And begin to call in these people, invite them to come in on Friday nights for a period of fellowship and strengthening and just brainstorming and jawboning. A period of time when they can be cared for. In addition to that, and for doing it on Friday night instead of on Sunday was done intentionally. One of my good friends said, you might better have it during the week rather than, if you have it on Sunday night, it's going to appear that you've started another congregation. And you know that's right. So I said, okay, that's good advice. So we're putting it on Friday night or Thursday night because we're not starting another congregation. One of the main things that we're hoping to do, and we've already gotten overwhelming partial commitment to it, we're going to ask those people in the neighborhood, neighboring churches, the neighboring congregations in the Boston area, to send there on Friday nights also some of their best leaders so that they can be a part of the training and a part of the receiving of those people, so that they then can find themselves being the receivers of those people back in the local congregations in that whole area. So what's going to happen as a second round of the effects is it's going to be a strengthening agent for those congregations. And I think that the church in the whole of Boston, or the whole of Massachusetts, and as a result from there, the whole of the Northeast is going to be strengthened immeasurably. Yesterday there were people from Connecticut, there were people from New Hampshire, from Western Mass, from perhaps Maine. You can drive an hour and a half or 2 hours and be anywhere in those. You know, you're not very far from anything up there. It's not like being in Oklahoma. I got to the office one day and my wife had left a note that said, I've gone to New Hampshire for lunch. It sounded so strange, but she meant by that she had driven 30 minutes and had gone up there to a restaurant, but it was in New Hampshire. But anyway, this is one of the more exciting things, is that not only will it surface those people who have been hurt and who have walked away from the Boston church, and it will pull them together and give them some hope by lifting up Jesus Christ and letting them love Him and see Him and believe in Him and get a whole new grasp on life. But it's also going to equip those people to be then channeled back out into the surrounding congregations, and it will strengthen those churches. The Burlington church has been helped immeasurably by those who come from the Boston movement. It's changed the face of the church in Burlington. And we needed a facelift. We weren't there. We were the other extreme. Boston is so rigid she'd have to lie down to be vertical. We're so horizontal we'd have to sit up to be horizontal. And you know, neither one of them is scriptural. And I'm hesitant about even saying anything about anybody because of the fact that there's so many two befores in my own eye in terms of that congregation where I am and in terms of any congregation where I've ever been. None of us is well-rounded. We're all out of balance. But anyway, it'll strengthen those congregations. And then a fourth, it's going to allow me on the weekends. I'm planning to travel on the weekends. I'll not be getting my support from Burlington. I've already resigned from there. I'll be traveling on the weekends for the purpose of telling not just this, though I know it'll be asked, but my main thrust will be to call us all to an alternative that has got to be really seriously considered. If not Boston, what? Because what's happened is that Boston is just simply taking pretty well the mindset that we've had, and brethren, whether we recognize this or not, I don't know. Maybe I'm off base. But I'm thinking that they've just taken the mindset that many times we have deteriorated into, and have simply added to it these two significant differences: the authority issue and the extremely well-oiled organization. But it's still basically the same message. It's still basically the same emphasis. And I know that may not even apply to here. But I'll tell you, I travel all over the country, and I'm seeing lots and lots of churches who will fall prey to Boston, because they see Boston doing the same thing they're doing, essentially, except they're doing it successfully. And that's why they're having such an enormous pull, and they're cleaning out the leadership of all these churches. You'd be surprised at the number of churches that are losing their leaders to them right now. If there was not a kindred ideology, if there were not a kindred perspective, they wouldn't be able to impact us like they've impacted us. So what I'm urging us to do is to, by the way, get in there and dig around and see if perhaps we need to come up with a viable option, another alternative. If it's not the Boston method, then what are we going to do? Are we just going to stay the way we are? Are we going to keep preaching the same message that we preached? Are we going to keep having the same emphasis that we've had? I think all of us are astute enough to know that somewhere along the line, we're not doing it. We're not doing it. We're a hurting movement. We are a movement in crisis. There's no question about that in my mind. We are a movement in crisis. And it's not going to be done. It's not going to be corrected by standing and writing hate letters and hate papers and stomping and cavorting and one part of the remnant calling the other remnant, names. That's not going to do it. We're going to have to find out what the alternative is. And the only alternative that brings life is Jesus Christ. Normally, when a movement reaches a position where it is virtually sterile soil, where it's come down to a zero growth, watch what will happen. We'll either reach out normally in one of three directions. We either reach out in emotionalism. A charismatic movement will spring up. It'll burst forth sure as we're sitting here. We either reach out in emotionalism, or we reach out in promotionalism. We get us a hotshot Fifth Avenue preacher from the pulpit who dresses like somebody that just stepped out of a hat box and who has all the, you know what I'm talking about. And there's more promotionalism than there is proclamation. We'll either reach out into promotionalism, or we'll reach out into a new legalism that just does it better than we've done. And not a single one of those brings life. The only thing that will bring life is Jesus Christ. And if we are the church of Christ, I think it certainly behooves us to find out the message of Christ. Well, I'm going to stop right here. But that's our plan, to become visible, to begin pulling the people together who have walked away, to begin funneling them to the local congregations around about in the Boston area. And then I'm going to be going out on the weekends pointing to an alternative that I think is the only hope we've got. And that's, I'll not be with Burlington there. I'll be traveling on the weekends. There are any number of ramifications that you can see. I told Al and them this. I said, personally, I'm going to see to it that as far as my direct involvement, I'm going to go for those who've already walked away. But that's not going to last long, I know. I told him, I said, I know what's going to happen. Those who have walked away are going to know 10 more, 7 of whom have not walked away but would give their right arm if they could. So I don't quite know how to address that. I know what I think of somebody who comes in and pulls away some weak people who are being taught by me. I know how I respond to that. And it stinks. And I know if I'm going to treat them like I'd like to be treated, I won't be able to do that intentionally. If it were only, and this is what has me confused, and I don't quite know how to. If it were only a theological difference in the sense of it being some kind of a theoretical difference, and I mean that all the way down to from their view of authority, whether it's the evangelist that has the authority or the elders, that, or whether it's their
a very visible organizational structure that's different from the one that we've got, and it violates what we call a biblical principle of autonomy. And that is that's a conclusion we've drawn, and I think it's valid. But you know, brethren, that's something we've had to arrive at. The word, that doesn't occur, as far as I know, in the New Testament. We've assumed it. It's a pretty clear picture that every congregation is independent from every other congregation. And yet you've got Jerusalem, and you've got a letter being sent to Antioch, and you've got a lot of things happening. And they're pillar churches. Antioch, in a sense, was a pillar church. If you want to get out and argue and get out and talk about theory and philosophies, they can point to Antioch in Syria. They can point to Rome. They can point to Jerusalem. They say, now, those are pillar churches. If it were anything like that, and I'll just about cut them slack, go about any of that the way you want to go about it, and if you're reaching souls for the Lord, go for it. I'm not going to spend my time arguing with you. But there's one other ingredient that has me, it's pushed me over the side to where I've had to move, and that is they're leaving behind such an enormous train of people who have been psychologically damaged. That's what's pushed me to the point where I said, okay, I'm going to do everything I can to turn that around. So that's where we are, and I appreciate your coming here. I haven't told, this is, except for yesterday, I told the brethren yesterday, and I notified the Boston church that this is what we're going to be doing. But other than that, this is the first place I've said anything about it publicly. I'm going to stop right now. There may be some questions that you have, but we've got about 20 minutes. Yes?
Tell us a little bit about how they are psychologically damaged. What are the results of that?
What are the results? Well, I'm not sure I can verbalize it. I just know what happens when they come to us. They will call, for example, and say, can you help me get away from them? And I'm going to have to move when they're not here. I'm going to have to move out when they're not here. And one man in New York called at 2 o'clock in the morning, not me, but called a brother in New York and said, I'll meet you down on the corner. It's things like this that are, and see, you say that, but that may be the person, the problem of the person. It may be that he's just maybe a weak person, and I don't know what it is, but somehow or another, it's damaging them psychologically to where normally they're a good year being able to even talk about it. They can't talk about it for a year. And then when they talk about it, another thing is says they can't read the Bible anymore because of these triggers. And, well, they mean by that there's some emphasis. A scripture has been taken and twisted out of its context and made such a pivotal scripture that every time they read it, it just is an emotional trigger that sets them off, just like a person who has been on drugs has a flashback is the nearest thing that I can explain. That's some of the psychologically damaged. For example, here was Sunday, this past Sunday, a lady who had left a year ago, whose husband is not yet a Christian, but he's still processing it. She had come and volunteered to take care of younger classes on Sunday morning. But that particular Sunday morning, yet last Sunday morning, she wasn't there. And so the ladies who were in there with her, when it came time, and they knew that just right before time for class to start, they called her and asked her what arrangements had she made. Would you think that would be all right or not all right? Well, we would think, well, you know, who would think anything about that? But her husband said, see there, I told you, they're just like the Boston church. And I thought, good grief. But what we didn't count on was that conditioning, there was somebody there saying, putting the screws to them. When we weren't doing that at all, we didn't intend for it to, but because of what had happened to them, they felt like, uh-oh, here it is again. So normal, just normal action toward people is interpreted as being the same kind of repressive action. Now, this tape that I hope you'll want, I hope you'll get it. I'm going to have to just leave it here with Howard, and you'll have to get it from him. It's going to give a biblical layout and a biblical exposure of both the text and of the system that will give substance to this. And until you get it, you probably won't be able to have much substance except what I'm saying tonight.
I've heard something about this, and I was just wondering.
Yes, he responded, and one brother came out and he said to me, I want to come by and talk. I said, I've got about 12 pages of notes. He said, I want you to tell me what it was he said. I said, well, he said it both ways. And Al is, he's a man that he, I think his heart is too loving to go ahead and push the final button. But I think they've gotten caught. I think the elders have gotten caught in between Kip, who has an enormous vision. I think they've gotten caught in between Kip and his pronouncements and the rest of the church, and I think they're finding themselves having to defend it, much like the Roman Church has to defend the infallibility of the Pope, because once it's ever admitted that there is a chink in that chain of authority, I think that the system would crumble. It's built on authority. Yeah. We have around 250 in attendance now. A year and a half ago, there were probably, or 2 years ago, there were probably 150. So, but it's, yes, we're not getting that many every week, but there are that many new people coming and looking, and who stay among us a while, and we encourage them, go back and stay if you possibly can. We don't encourage them to come. We try not. There are times when we do because we've heard their story. But there are those that we're saying, look, if you can work it out and stay, stay. I was saying that a year ago. I'm not sure that I can remember saying that recently because I'm having a hard time. I'm having a hard time with it. I just need to be real careful.
Oh, we don't say that here.
No. Yeah.
Okay. If somebody visits us from his church, we say, come on over.
Yeah. All right.
Would you mind to respond to the question that came up yesterday that we weren't too clear on concerning what lordship baptism is?
Okay, you mentioned that. I'm not sure that I can answer that definitively firsthand. Jerry Jones has answered it, and it has to do with an assertion that they make that when people are in the mainstream are baptized, they're not really baptized confessing Jesus as Lord. They're only confessing him as the Christ, the Son of God. And it's connected with the statement that they make about counting the cost. Lordship baptism is connected with counting the cost. One brother who came to us just recently, who preached before he went there, he was down in Louisiana, and he came and to be a part of the Boston church, and they sat him down and they said, now, we want to know whether you're willing to count the cost. And will you do that? He said, no, I won't. He said, I counted the cost when I became a Christian. And he said, what you're wanting me to do is count the cost to see whether or not I'll be willing to do it what you say ought to be done, the way you say it ought to be done. He says, I won't do that. Well, he's no longer with them. Of course, that didn't last very long. But that's primarily what it refers to. And I know they might not agree to that because what they're doing, they're equating their demands on people with the demands of Christ. So what they're saying essentially is, will you surrender to Jesus Christ as Lord? But the practical working out of that means, will you surrender to your discipler in the same way that you would surrender to Christ, and whatever your discipler tells you, you just do it. Don't ask any questions. Now that sounds harsh, but rather it's been documented over and over and over again. And they are equating, and they say that the authority that a discipler has over the disciplee is the same as the authority that Jesus Christ has over his disciples. And that if you rebel against the authority of your discipler, it is the same thing as tantamount to rebelling against Jesus Christ. And what has happened is that they have essentially and have effectively placed someone in between the person and his Lord. And that's, in fact, yesterday in it's on this tape. Yesterday, it was stated that there must be a coach. Now catch this if you can. There must be a coach that works alongside of every new Christian. Does that ring any bell? There must be a coach. What, you're nodding, what would you say?
Comforter.
That, I said, are you aware of the fact that you have just then effectively translated the word paraclete? I said, the Holy Spirit himself is called our coach, our player coach, the one that runs along beside us and coaches us. And I said, what you've done is you've placed someone in between the coach and the person. You put someone in between. Okay, yes.
What you've been describing sounds a lot like what we were hearing a few years ago in regard to Buddhism and some other modern cults. And it's difficult to put, to really get a handle on this psychological damage.
Yes.
And ultimately, people working in the field coming out of that have to set up a deep program.
Yes.
And don't you see that this is what you've got to do eventually?
You said that, I didn't. But, but I, when Al asked me the other day, do you believe we're cult? I said, definitely. He says, no question about it. Historically, you're cultic. Every movement that springs off and is every movement that begins, at that beginning point in history, is a cult. I mean by that, they have a cult mentality. They have a charismatic leader. They have all of the characteristics of a cult. And then some have characteristics that are demonic. But Christianity, when it started, was a cult. It had the historical qualifications of a cult. If you understand what I mean by that, it's. And Reinhold Niebuhr wrote his book on social sources of denominationalism, and put it as the period of the man, the period of the message, the movement, and the monument. Every movement that starts as a period of the man, and that's what we have here. But Al asked me, "Do you think we're a cult?" And I said, "Very definitely. Historically, you're a cult." And I said, the results that I'm seeing in some of the people, in the people that we're seeing, indicate that you're cultic in the way you are approaching people. And I'm sorry to say that, but I'm convinced it's true.
Has Jerry Jones addressed this and talked about it during your interview?
I don't think he's addressed that. He's addressed in the Atlanta discourse there with the Atlanta Highlands Church. On the day that they split, the congregation split, he met there with them that night by their request and addressed four major areas that he was concerned about. Now, but that wasn't one of them. Yes?
Jim, you mentioned a few minutes ago that you thought that there were others in the group who would like to get out if they could. What do you mean by that expression, if they could?
Well, I mean by that that if they thought there was an alternative, that there are those who are ignorant of the alternative, but they would get out if they were aware of an alternative. Secondly, I'm convinced that there are people in it who are there, who are in it, and they can't get away. They've been psychologically hooked strongly enough, they can't get away. Now that's serious, but I'm convinced from all I've talked with. In fact, one girl is living in the basement of my house right now. She left. And she said, I've got to get away. I'm losing my sanity. I can't get away. I've got to get away. So she said, I've told them, and I'm going to leave at a time when they are gone at work. And will you help me get away? Will you help me move out? And I said, yes, I'll help you. So I took my truck and we went and helped her move. She's in the basement of our house. The next day, she called up the Native Church. And she's going back. She got away, but they got to her. And they are skilled at putting guilt trips on you. They are so skilled at it. They'll bring the scriptures to bear on you in a way that you never dreamed. And when they're talking with you about it, you'll almost say, man, that makes sense. It makes sense. Did you hear that yourself? Well, you see, that's a perspective then that allows them any number of wide methods to use to bring about guilt. That's the same, essentially the same thing that they have accepted if legalism, if that is the most effective way of getting people to move, then we'll use legalism. Why don't we just, you can raise your hand if you want, and then you can hand in your name.
Pass around some papers here if you want one.
Yes.
$25.
I believe I can get them to you for $20, including postage.
You mentioned the Native Church. Are there other churches that are affiliated in New England?
That are affiliated
with the Boston Church?
No. The Native Church is among those that are picking up on those that have walked away.
Okay, yeah. They're not part of the same.
No, no.
Okay.
And there are two, there's a Christian church in Acton who they have been impacted by about 20 or so people, 30 maybe by now. The church of Southeastern has about now 20 or 30 members there.
Lot, but we're still just getting the, just the hem of the garment. We're just barely touching the hem of the garment. Yeah, Monroe.
Jim, you made a statement somewhere in this that it is a different gospel. I'd like to actually agree with just one theology and so on. But you also expressed an understandable reluctance to make contact with people who were still in it, though they might be disillusioned.
Yes.
And I can understand that. Yeah, it seems to me that...
It's inconsistent.
It is a different gospel. In fact, it looks like to me that if you started drawing parallels with religious Romanism, when you look at the authority thing, you look at the works theology, there's an awful shocking parallel there.
Yeah.
And what I'm wondering is, why can't we, in good conscience, if a religious Romanist was disillusioned, we would certainly want to try to lead him out of that. And it looks to me like that this is a message that is, it's not just technology.
Yeah.
It's theology. And with disillusioned people, it looks to me like that you could, with good conscience, reach.
Well, I think the reason why I'm backing off of doing it is because I don't want that to become the direction and the intention. I don't want that to dominate what we're doing. I want it to be a positive approach. And I'm thinking that the Lord's going to take care of people, knowing it's going to get back to them in spite of anything they do.
Sure.
So I think if we're, because there are enough people who are out who are attacking and who are going for the jugular in ways that are not, I think are not, I couldn't do it at least. But
I
think...
I understand that and I appreciate your spirit. But what you're saying is not a denial of the fact that it is that consequential and that much off-center with regard to gospel message. It is a different gospel,
isn't it,
really? And it is
worse
theology.
It's, yes, very definitely. Though they don't see it like that. See, this is, none of this do they see or will they accept. But if the deviation in the book of Galatians, if it is a true definition of another gospel, then I can't draw any other conclusion but that this is another gospel. Of course, I've been saying for years that Galatians 1, 6, and 9, while we pointed other people with a finger of accusation, three of them are pointing back at us. The two issues that Paul addresses in the book of Galatians are, number one, that justification is by works and that sanctification is by legislation. And that may be too hard, but I've said this at the college church in Searcy 10 years ago, that it surprises us when Paul says, though we or an angel from heaven preach any other gospel to you than that which we preach to you, let him be cursed. I said, we've used that on people forever. And I said, it shocked I'm not sure what I said. I probably said it shocked the britches off of me one day to realize that the very thing I was accusing other people of, the two things when I learned what the issue was in Galatians, and that is that justification is by faith, it's not by merit, and that sanctification is by the Spirit of God, not by legislation. And I know that you might not think, well, that's not the way I do it, and that's fine, that's great, but you'd be surprised at how widespread is how we've slipped into a reactionary message, because we felt like the Baptists had taken an improper emphasis and said that salvation is by faith only. And we've come away saying, no, it's salvation by faith, but, and we then define it in such a way that it almost brings it to the point that unless you measure up unless you measure up in every way, you really can't be a Christian. And then that sanctification is by measuring up again to certain standards of morality and all, and that it's not really by the Spirit, it's by benevolent legalism. We're guilty of benevolent legalism. That's all you can say about it. And the only reason why we can get away with it is because the bulk of the people to whom we have presented ourselves have been near enough like us in our own morality that it doesn't take all that much legalism to bring them back just like we are. Yes or no? Is that a valid... The reason why we can get by with a benevolent legalism is that we have approached only those people who in their morals are sufficiently like us that it doesn't take all that much tampering and goading for them to act just like us. If we were approaching the people like the Gentiles in the first century, a people who were as different from us morally as the Gentiles were different from the Jews of the first century, we would not have been able to approach them with the benevolent legalism that we've possessed. Now, brethren, I know that some of these things, and I've been out in the boonies for so long, and I may even be out of touch with where we are, but I'm convinced that we're nearer to that position than we like to admit. And then when they come, you know, the way they justify what they're doing as far as putting requirements and stipulations, and you can only date in couples, and you can't, you know how they justify that? They say, you don't understand the kind of people we're converting. They don't have any kind of moral upbringing at all. And I say to them, are you aware that that's exactly what the Judaizing teachers said about the Gentiles of the first century? That's how they justified doing what they did. Well, I know this, that we can't go there. We can't go to these brethren without taking at least part of the blame for their being where they are. They had some pretty good role models in some of us. And I know that probably there's nobody here that would be such that I could say, that we could say, yes, I'm one of those, or that you're one of them. But you know, among us, there is a pretty good vocal minority that I refer to as the original remnant. These are just also rans. We've got the original among us. Any other questions? Yes.
How much does fatigue play a part in these drop off of
their movement? Tremendous. Burnout. Emotionally, but physically as well. Single parents, single mothers. Man, they're so tired, they can't move. They're just literally exhausted. That's a good question. Physical burnout does have a part in it. Yes.
Jim, there's a psychological condition called post-trauma stress that would well describe the symptoms that you're describing to these people.
Post-trauma stress, okay.
I don't know all the symptoms, but just from the few that you mentioned tonight, well, it would sound like that would be pretty typical of a lot of these people who have just walked away, tired, confused.
Yes.
Uncertain, withdrawn.
Guilty. I don't know whether that's part of it, but the guilt is a major part.
Can you have a reading from the elders on how they're going to respond to your work?
Nothing written. You mean the elders of the Boston Church?
Yes.
No, except that they said, if you're going after those, you know, try to reclaim those that we've lost, fine, God bless you. But then when I said, you know, it's going to bleed back up into the movement. And then Al said, you mean you're asking me to give you a list of those so that you can do us in? I said, yeah, I know that's the way it looks, and I'm aware of that, but it's not going to work now. But that's essentially, of course, what could they say? You know, they don't really, if they had said, we're not going to give you the list because we don't want those people to be saved, they wouldn't have done that. But I don't know whether they're going to be able to handle, and I don't know whether we're going to be able to handle the implications when we go to those people who have walked away and they say, I know six right now, and I'm going to tell them about this. Because they're ropes in. What am I going to tell them? Don't tell them? I can't. They'll have to handle that themselves. All I'm going to do is make sure that my direct approach is to the people who've already left. And that the message in the newsletters is a positive message that lifts up Jesus Christ. Because I wouldn't think about going to get anybody from anything without bringing them to Jesus Christ and letting Him be the Lord of their life. And let them come to believe in Him with all their heart, love Him with everything that's in them. And then we just tell these people, now, just go at it to your heart's content. When you get tired, quit. And the Lord will restore your spirit, and you can go at it again. Just do it as much as you like to, and pray the Lord will increase your life. And after about it, so often they'll come by and they'll say, I'm so excited, I'm about to jump out of my skin. I'm so happy. My joy has been restored. But then they'll have those flashbacks, and boy, they go in and out of it. And I don't know how long it's going to take them to get out of it permanently. But this has sounded terribly critical tonight, and I really wish that you would let me have the recording, because I'm afraid that what we've said tonight would so, though I've said them to Al and to those men, I don't know. But what do you think? I know that we have this recording here, and you've heard me, and normally I always. When someone asked me to speak on a subject once, they said, you don't mind if I record this, do you? I said, absolutely, I demand that you record it. I don't want you going out of here saying what I said. I want it to be on tape.